system of laboratories that NOAA maintains offers the possibility of having the continuity of purpose to put together a coherent plan that would last over a number of years for solving a problem. In other words, a climate investigation. And that was the thing which really attracted me to NOAA. And so Bill Hess came along and offered me the job of coming in here as his deputy. And I said yes. That was the main reason. The other reason was that my wife didn't want to come to Washington, but she was willing to come to Boulder. Mm-hmm. So I had maintained the household in Seattle when I left the university for those 3 years. So anyway, it turned out that way, and the first coherent plan, an investigation, was to investigate the tropical Pacific.
Mm-hmm. Now your office was where?
Here.
I mean, where here? Up at NCAR or?
Down
here on the campus?
Yeah, we have a set of buildings on the South Campus, rented from the university. We're building a building to consolidate into right now and have money in the bank to do it. Mm-hmm. But they're still occupying, in fact, the rented buildings from the University of Colorado. But that was the headquarters for the NOAA laboratory system. Mm-hmm. There's 11 laboratories now. There were 9, I guess, at that time. We've revamped it a little bit. But the headquarters was all here, so you could put together, you might say, a broad, long-range plan. By its nature, it has to be interdisciplinary. It's not something you can go out and do in 1 year. It has to be done over a span of years. And so the initial plan for doing this, we called EPOCS, Equatorial Pacific Ocean Climate Studies. And see, I came to NOAA in September 74. I presented the plan and the budget initiative first in 76, but it didn't get approved in 76. That is, I didn't get out of NOAA. Bob White was the head of NOAA. But the next year, in 77, Bob got behind it, and that was the budget for 78. So that was the first year of actual funding. So we started the investigation then, and it developed into a whole series of things. I mean, EPOCS became a broader program, an interagency, and for a brief time, this had the acronym OASIS, and that was transformed, that was adopted by the World Climate, the WMO, and became TOGA. Tropical Ocean Global Atmosphere, and it became a program of the World Climate Program thrust. And you know, in relatively short time, EPOCS became expanded until it had about 20 countries making contributions, and here we are 15 years later, and I think this has pretty well been worked out. I mean, I think we've solved the the toga problem, the interaction between the ocean and the atmosphere. It can now be modeled with credible models in the atmosphere and ocean side. Made a lot of progress, more or less achieved those initial objectives. But the culmination of this that I think is really the most important, nobody's heard about yet, except me and a couple of other people. And that is, as epochs developed into toga, we came to understand the dynamics of the ocean and the atmosphere in the tropical Pacific, all right. And that's where the action is. But what we've come to realize later is let me hit two or three points. Number one, what changes about global climate? I mean, which parameter reflects the important changes? The answer to that is not, global surface temperature, as you read so much about. Hell, that's probably one of the worst things that you could have guessed.
It's not a good indicator.
The most influential factor is the strength of the global circulation of the atmosphere. And so you ask the question, is that really a variable? I mean, does that vary from decade to decade and century to century and so on? So you have to look at the record. And there I left out something I meant to mention. And that is, while at Rand, I mentioned that after doing the Antarctic study, I ran up against a stone wall because there was not data from the global ocean. I went up to Monterey, and Paul Wolf was head of the Fleet Numerical Center at Monterey. Paul had been the aide to the senior Navy officer at Anchorage when I was in Alaska. Mm-hmm. And I had taken the two of them on a flight to the North Pole at one time. So he was a lieutenant in those days, but we had met. And that's probably the reason I heard that he was running the Navy Center out there. Anyway, that's one of the things I need to give the Navy credit for, is that Paul gave us very sympathetic ear to the problem of not having usable data from the world ocean, put it that way. And I think it was the Navy, and mainly the Fleet Numerical Center, who initiated the initiative at that time to get this archived. And it was then picked up by various others who pitched in, but I think it was Monterey that really started that off, and mainly Paul. Mm-hmm. And he had a guy working for him named, it was a Latvian name.
Taivo?
Yes.
Brahe? Taivo? Taivo?
It was Taivo something, yeah.
Yeah, short guy, full of energy.
Yeah.
See, I was an oceanographer meteorologist there. I went through the course. Took me to the Arctic.
I remember it was Paul and Taivo who really carried the water on this. And it was later picked up by the WMO and various others. They ended up splitting it up among different countries. The Germans took responsibility for the Atlantic, for example. They did a good job. The Dutch took responsibility for the Indian Ocean, and they did a good job. The U.S. took responsibility for the Pacific, and they did a mediocre job. It wasn't near as good as the Dutch and the Germans. But the upshot was that they dug out all this back data since 1854, digitized it, put it on tape. So when I came to Boulder, this was sort of the situation. There was a lot of tape. It wasn't all done yet at that time. It amounted to about 800 tapes.
Now, what was your position at Fuller? You were in charge of all the labs worldwide, the NOAA labs?
The deputy, Bill Hess was in charge of the labs.
Of the labs?
Oh, yeah, and I was just...
Wasn't he in charge of NOAA?
What?
Was he in charge of NOAA or just the labs?
No, just the labs.
Just the labs, okay.
Yeah.
I got you.
And I came in as his deputy. But anyway, I took a look at the situation. I was to say, after a couple of years, the Germans had done a nice job, and the Dutch, and there were about 800 tapes altogether that had all this digitized stuff on them. It amounted to about 150 million observations from 1854 up to 1979 at that time. And but it was unusable, mm-hmm. because it was in different formats, some of it. There were errors that had to be traced down and whatnot, and it needed to be brought together, sorted out in time and space, and compressed and put in a usable form. And so I submitted initiatives in NOAA for 3 years running to do this without any success, really. And finally, I made an agreement with a couple of other people in NOAA, the head of the data service, for example, that even without any budget initiative and without any support, let's just start doing it. And we have to be at a very low level, because hell, you can't afford to do very much of it. But let's lay out the task and start doing it, which we did. And the upshot was what is now known as the COADS data set. And that is all of the data. It's now about 500 million observations. More than that now, I guess, because they were adding to it at the rate of about 100 million a year in recent years. But originally, from 1854 to 1979, it was about 150 million. We brought it all together. It was examined for errors in programming and so on. It was sorted out in time and space. It was formatted in a 2-degree grid by month. And to read through, we finally, it took a year or so to bring together from the Dutch and the Germans and other sources all of the basic data sets. And to read, to just read through it without doing anything to reformat or anything else, at that time was about $100,000 worth of computer time, just to read through the goddamn thing once. And that was a problem. And when Bill Hess left NOAA, he became head of IDCAR, mm-hmm. and they were buying a new Cray. And I got Bill, they had a run-in period, a test period, which lasted about 3 months, I think it was. Well, anyway, I got Bill to dedicate like a third of that time of the new Cray to sorting out this bunch of tapes. And that was the initial sorting out, which was a lot of the work, because most of the others, from then on, it was mostly refinement, you know. Mm-hmm. And of course, that is the basic source of our knowledge about how the climate has behaved, the dynamics of the system over the last 150 years.
A valuable tool for predicting global change.
Well, it's the only way you can find out how the system behaves. Now, what do you find out? the thing that you find out is that the most important variable is the strength of the circulation. And the strength of the circulation has changed radically over time. And most of the change takes place suddenly, gradually also, but the biggest change takes place suddenly. And over the last century, most of the change took place on about three or four different dates. Since 1854, the strength of the global circulation was stronger in the 1850s and 60s than it is today or ever has been between. After peaking in the 1860s, in about the 1874, about the mid-70s, there was a sharp decrease. And that's one of the few discontinuities in time I'm talking about. Then there continued to be a decrease and, you know, some variability until about 1900, and there was another very sharp decrease occurred about 1900. And then with variability, it continued to decrease so that the minimum was in the 1920s and 30s. And since then, it's been increasing with sudden increases about, maybe you could say around 1940, but mostly about 1962 and 1976 are the two dates that stand out.
For what happened in 62 and 76?
There was sudden
decrease?
Sudden jostling of the global system, put it that way.
Okay.
But it's on the increase, and especially since 1976, there's been a rapid increase. Now, to put this in perspective, you'd like to know what changes, where does it change, how does it spread?
What drives it?
And a whole bunch of things. And I can give you an outline and say, in 1875 or 74 or so, the sudden decrease in the strength of the wind, and of course, mind you, all we have is the surface Alps. Mm-hmm. The sudden decrease was strongest in the northern hemisphere higher latitudes, in the northern hemisphere westerlies. And the mean speed of the surface wind, for example, over the North Atlantic decreased about 2 meters per second against a background of, say, 7.5. That's a big change.
Mm-hmm.
That's like a third, almost. On the other hand, the big decrease at around 1900 was not there. You could see that 1875 change all over the planet, and it's reflected in the southern hemisphere all the way down to the southern hemisphere westerlies. But it's weaker as you go south, and as I say, was strongest in the northern hemisphere westerlies. The 1900 signal was a sudden decrease that was strongest in the southern hemisphere westerlies. And again, it was a sudden drop of about 2 or 3 meters a second against a slightly higher average of, say, 7.5 meters per second. And that was really sharp. It occurred in about a space of a year, 2 years. At the same time, the monsoon rainfall in India dropped by about a third. The discharge of the Nile River dropped by a third. The monsoon rainfall in China increased by 25%. And you can see the signal all over the world. The Colorado River changed by about 15-20%. And so these are the kind of things. And so the problem can be summarized by saying how do you understand the changes in the strength of the circulation? And when the circulation changes, of course, a lot of other things change. For example, evaporation is proportional to the, not the square, but the first power of the surface wind. And so you change the surface wind by 20, 30%, you change evaporation by 20, 30%. And if you change evaporation by 20, 30%, what goes up eventually must come down. Mm-hmm. It means a similar change in rainfall, in precipitation, and in heat. The heat, when it evaporates, is taken from the ocean. When it condenses, it's given to the atmosphere, but in a different place and in a different elevation and so on. But these are huge changes. And mm-hmm. what I'm saying mm-hmm. is, this is what characterizes a global climate. And all the other parameters can be derived from this. So the question is, how do you explain these sudden changes? Well, about 4 or 5 years ago did I feel we were getting on top of this, which I think we are now. And that was when I realized that, you know, everybody has talked about the, you know, the maximum sea surface temperature in the tropics and whatnot. And that's not the problem. The problem is the amount of deep convection, mm-hmm. 60,000 foot type, you know, because that's what drives the Hadley circulation. Mm-hmm. That's what creates most of the high clouds and so on. And it's not the amount of, or the temperature of the surface, or the maximum temperature, that is significant. The thing that is significant is the area of ocean mm-hmm. that is above the critical temperature that triggers deep convection.
And that's
28.5 degrees. You can use 29 or 28.
28.5. You mentioned it earlier.
But 28.5 is the most accurate.
And what's that figure called? What's the acronym for it?
I don't know of any name for it.
I don't have a...
don't know if it has a name.
The critical temperature.
The first person
deep convection temperature.
Yeah, the first person I know of who pointed this out was Herb Riehl back in World War II days. And Herb Riehl and Joanne Simpson did a classic paper on this, in which they pointed out that the whole global atmosphere could be driven from the tropics by something like 1,100, I think was the number, of deep convection columns. Mm-hmm. And that this was a very nonlinear process. I mean, if you start warming the surface ocean, nothing much happens except, low cumulus and so on, until you get to this critical temperature. Now, there are a bunch of things that are suppressing convection. Of course, there are the thermodynamic properties, the amount of buoyancy that is created by the column itself. There's the, you're a pilot, as you very well know, the shear, the vertical shear mm-hmm. is a very important limiting factor. And the point of it is that there is a certain temperature at which deep convection starts to occur because it overcomes all these inhibiting factors. Mm-hmm. And that's about 28.5 degrees. And the first person that I think who really seized on this was Herb Riehl, probably. Mm-hmm. But anyway, the thing that is critical is the amount of the tropical ocean that this deep convection goes on in. And that is the area that is warmer than this critical temperature. Mm-hmm. And if you stop to think for a minute, you know, that makes lots of sense, because if you see, I recently have gotten a hold of some photographs taken from space of the convective area in the Western Pacific. And you might say all of the area takes part in the process. in the columns, the deep columns itself, the upward vertical speed is probably 10 times bigger, maybe 15, I don't know the right number, than areas of substance. Mm-hmm. But most of the of what goes up in the column, fast moving columns, is substance that is local. According to Jock Kuttner, who's been the, you know, the program manager for the Toga Core, mm-hmm. Jock says this is like 75%.
It's local in the tropics.
It's local.
Right, so back in the tropics.
In the tropics, yeah. I mean, mesoscale.
Yeah, yeah.
The other 25% or 20% is what drives the mid-ocean highs. And that's large-scale substance that we, you know, have read about in the textbooks. Mm-hmm. So the point is that all of the area is taking place either as a region of substance or of updraft. And so the total amount of area, you know, is proportional to the total amount of activity. Mm-hmm. And that's what drives, that's the basic engine that drives the short-term changes, year to year. Now, one manifestation of that is the El Nino, mm-hmm. and the ocean reacts in various ways. And now, Toga has become, you know, the primary instrument for year to year climate prediction. But the same feature, that namely the region of deep tropical convection, that is responsible for the Toga type variability, is also what reflects the century scale variability. But it's not apparently related to the Toga process itself. And this is one of the things that I've been bemused about in recent years, is what is driving the longer term variability. Because the first thing that I came across is that if you look at it on a decadal scale and longer, again, you see a beautiful correlation between the size of the warm pool and the strength of the circulation. Mm-hmm. In particular, what I did is that I looked at the, you know, with the COADS data set, you can do this. We had the COADS data set, you know, there was nothing.
COADS data set is?
The Consolidated Ocean Atmosphere.
Okay.
The Maori.
I got you, yeah.
Data. Anyway, compare the size of the warm pool, mm-hmm. Warmer than, say, 28.5, and compare it with the strength of the circulation. And of course, the index that we can get our hands on easily is just look at the surface wind and average it, say, from 30 north to 30 south. That includes half the surface of a sphere and the whole tropics and subtropics and so on. And you find that they correlate exactly.
Hmm.
On a year-to-year basis, on a decade-to-decade basis.
So what drives the growth and shrinking of the warm pool?
You put your finger on the key question.
Yeah.
And if you had asked me that 3 months ago, I'd have said no more than that. That's a key question. But about 2 months ago, I happened to come across a guy who was in Boulder. He had been invited to Boulder by INCAR and by the Space Environment Lab from the University of Berlin. And it turns out that this group at Berlin had been contracted by NASA to recalibrate their measurements of the solar constant. You know, they had a cavity instrument that they've been flying now for, by now it's about 20 years, for measuring the solar constant outside the Earth's atmosphere. And they had never been satisfied with the translation of their measurement into the solar constant that they could believe. So they, the University of Berlin had expertise here. So they have a contract for doing this. Number one, they conclude that the variability is actually 4 to 5 times greater than NASA had thought, or anybody had thought. That's a key.
The variability of the size of the solar pool?
No. The variability of the sun's irradiance.
Irradiance, okay.
Measured outside the Earth's atmosphere.
I got you.
The second thing is that they find that there are certain reactions which occur between high energy protons and certain elements of the Earth's atmosphere which create new isotopes. Chlorine 37 is one of them. I think it's cesium 10 and chlorine 37 are two key ones. But the point is that these isotopes are later entrained in the atmosphere and show up in the ice cores.
Mm-hmm.
So that by analyzing the ice cores, they've enlisted the Swiss group and the French group at Grenoble, and they're able to come up with what the solar constant has been at various times in the past.
Back down through the Vostok cores?
They've run it back as far as 1650 already, mm-hmm. which is the Maunder minimum of solar mm-hmm. activity. It's been known for a long time. And the results are beautiful, really, to look at.
Is there a cycle? Can you identify a cycle?
Yes. And that's the next, but first I want to emphasize that if you can identify the cycles that are responsible, just as you say, you can not only trace and validate the past, but project into the future, which we've never had a way of doing before, because up to then, the question has been the one you ask, what controls the size of the warm pool? And we had no explanation that really hangs together on that. But now it appears that the main thing that controls the size of the warm pool is the strength of the solar radiation. And the 11-year cycle is minor. That's almost noise in this. The two cycles that dominate are the 88-year cycle, which is the Gleisberg cycle, and a 207-year cycle. And I don't know what the classical name for that is.
88-year cycle is the which cycle?
Gleisberg.
Gleisberg and 207 years.
And then 207, and they dominate the record.
Mm-hmm.
So by projecting these two, and they're not exactly in phase, you know, you get an irregular.
Oh, they go differently.
They go differently.
You got one that's doing it like this, and the other one's.
But if you take that combined record and compare it with the COAD record, back as far, it reflects beautifully the things I've mentioned, 1875, 1900, 1976, even 1962, and so on. So the validation appears very good indeed. And as I say, you can project it mm-hmm. into the future as you please.
And, interesting.
Well, it's fascinating.
Absolutely fascinating.
Because in my mind, what is clear is that this is what dominates your question, what controls the size of the warm pool. It's reflected almost immediately in the size of the warm pool, because the Pacific Ocean is the great gatherer of solar energy. And if you look at the ocean circulation, or the surface circulation in the Pacific, and the total amount of energy that's involved and so on, you know, my point is that the ocean gathers it beautifully. The wind system is such that the ocean carries it right to the Western Pacific. And the record, mainly from COADs, and the record from the solar records, as I say, just agree beautifully. Now, and as a corollary to what I'm saying, is that the IPCC, you know, the Intergovernmental Panel.
International Panel on the
Global Climate.
Global Climate.
This is mostly baloney. I mean, my point is that 35 years ago, Manabe and Weatherall at GFDL did a one-dimensional calculation, you know, of the effect of doubling CO2, and they came up with 3 degrees centigrade.
That's if you double it.
What?
That's if you double it.
That's a doubling.
They haven't doubled.
From 300 to 600, roughly.
Yeah.
No, we haven't. But my point, that was the result they came up with. Being a one-dimensional calculation, that's assuming that everything else remains constant or that all the feedback loops cancel, neither one of which.
It's only atmospheric.
Atmospheric, yes.
Yeah, doesn't take into account the ocean absorption of heat.
But my point is that today, with expensive GCMs and big computers and so on, the GCMs give the same result. Now that says the same thing, that either all the feedback loops cancel or everything else remains constant, both of which we know is not so. So what I'm saying is that the GCM, I'd call it almost a spurious result. It really has no credibility in nature. But the argument in the WMO has been, we know so little about the dynamics of climate that we have no other method of estimating.
So throw money at it.
Throw money at it, exactly. Yeah. And, you know, it's been, for the last 20 years, it's been obviously grossly wrong. But it's not until now that we have an alternative explanation that makes sense and is credible and can be verified with observations. And so the whole damn international community has adopted this point of view of saying, well, we have no better way of doing it, so just run the GCM and accept the results for making international policy. And now Al Gore and Tim Wirth are trying to beat all the other countries into line to get them to agree to mandatory emission standards in the year 2000, roughly aimed at the 1990 levels. And, you know, two things you could say. One, it's impossible that they can succeed with this, but they can create a hell of a lot of commotion in doing it. And two, it's unnecessary because CO2 is not that important by any means. The real importance is the process that I've described.
It's absolutely fascinating. I understand.
Yeah, well, this is what I'm wrapped up in now, and I'm very...
This is a personal project now?
Yeah, it's a personal project.
When did you retire?
What?
When did you retire from NOAA?
Oh, about 4 years ago, or 92. Yeah, I retired the beginning of 92.
Your NOAA career or your government service career is as long as your Air Force career.
Yeah, roughly. But it's going to work. My point is that when I got out of the Air Force, I adopted this problem. And I remember at the time, my wife and I had some long talks about this, is that I said, you know, I would like to finish in a dead heat. I'd like to be around when this problem is solved, but not too much. I want the problem to be solved by the time I die, but not too much before. But I'd like to work on it for the rest of my time.
But basically, what you're saying is that there's not a whole hell of a lot we can do to affect it. We can't.
That's right.
And all the worry about the carbon cycle and And global warming due to increased carbon dioxide is actually a minimal...
Completely unnecessary. In fact...
Except for places where it gets thick enough to breathe, and then you want to reduce it, like Beijing and a few places like that.
In fact, I subscribe to you an opposite point of view, you might say. I've researched this question of the biological aspects of the carbon cycle and so on. And my conclusion is that the best world expert that I know of is an employee of the Department of Agriculture. Mm-hmm. He's the chief scientist at the Agricultural Research Institute at Phoenix, Arizona. Mm-hmm. There's a guy named Itso. And I've talked to him on, I've never met him. I've talked to him on the phone, but I read his book. He wrote a book, and he has written several other things. And a few months back, I phoned him, got in touch with him, and you might say that's the first time we've been acquainted even to talk. And he sent me, since then, a couple of his more recent publications. But briefly, let me give you his point of view, which, as I say, he's the guy I would turn to for information of this sort, because I think he knows more about it and has looked at it more thoroughly than anybody else that I know of. And he would say, I'm putting this in my own interpretation now, if you look at other planets, for example, you find that there are quite a few planets, you know, that have gaseous atmospheres. But most of them are dominated by carbon dioxide. Take Venus, for example, mm-hmm. or you give all sorts of other examples. Only the Earth do we have the combination that we have here. The Earth's atmosphere is, you know, it's 21% oxygen and 78% nitrogen, and within the one remaining percent you have all the other gases, of which carbon dioxide is a minute quantity, only about 300 parts per million, mm-hmm. Which means that, you know, it's a fraction of a 100th of 1%. Instead of being 80 or 90%. And why is this? Because, you know, there has been time in the evolution of the Earth for the biological activity on Earth to reach a balance. And that if, for example, plant life on Earth, which generates oxygen and which devours carbon dioxide, if plant life died on Earth, it would take something like 100,000 years in which oxygen would be a trace gas. Then we would have a largely dominated carbon dioxide mm-hmm. atmosphere. So it's the balance between these voracious life forms, which constitute the vegetable kingdom, which consume carbon dioxide, that has both generated oxygen and reduced the level of carbon dioxide. Now, it's Itso's premise, it's explained in his book, that these voracious eaters of carbon dioxide, namely the plant kingdom, have reduced it to such a level that certain types of plant activity have, in fact, been extinguished, and some have been retarded. And if it is decreased much more, there will be a drastic breakdown in the plant kingdom. Mm-hmm. So you're close to a dangerously minimal level right now. If you double the carbon dioxide from 3 parts per million, 300 parts, to 600, plant activity would increase by somewhere between 30% and 50%, but probably closer to 50 than 30. Mm-hmm. Which would be a very beneficial thing. And when, if you combine that with the factors that I have been talking about, increased evaporation, increased rainfall, and so on, then it makes a 50% increase much more credible. And so, according to his arguments and his analysis, there's nothing but gain in an increase in carbon dioxide levels.
Otherwise, man is contributing to the atmosphere beneficially.
Yes. Yes, and there...
I believe you're right. I've studied this a little bit.
There's quite a lot of observational evidence to support this point of view, too. And my point is...
Most of those plants are in the ocean.
A great deal of them, too.
Well, they produce more oxygen in the ocean than you do on dry land.
Let me put it in perspective in this way. When you'd have heating, whether it's from greenhouse effect or whether it's from solar constant, there are three important negative feedback loops. One is the dynamic loop that I have described, mm-hmm. which says that if the size of the warm pool increases, the strength of the circulation increases, evaporation increases, precipitation increases, and that's one negative feedback loop, which suppresses the warming effect. A second one has to do with radiative exchange due to clouds. And a guy named Ramanathan, you may know him, he used to be at NCARB, he's now at Scripps.
I think I do know him because of Scripps.
He's an Indian scientist. Yeah. Ramanathan is the expert on this. It used to be that the GCM modelers would claim that all three of these feedback loops were positive rather than negative. Mm-hmm. But now it's pretty well established that they're negative. Ramanathan has shown using the Herbie data that the effect of cloudiness, and the cloudiness is generated by the deep convection that I was talking mm-hmm. about. That's the main influence.
Increased.
It's almost starving to death now because the CO2 levels are so low, would be greatly enhanced by additional CO2. Mm-hmm. And that's in two parts. One part is the uptake by land vegetation and the observations of CO2 levels of the last several years. That's one of the conclusions of the NOAA laboratory, one of the ERL laboratories that's based here at Boulder. Monitors this, and they have a big sink in the biological sink, put it that way, that they haven't been able to account for, and that by process of elimination, it must be due to a much greater uptake by plant life than anybody had thought. But the other part of that is what you're talking about, the enhancement of plankton growth. Mm-hmm. In the ocean, which in turn takes up CO2 for the plankton growth, but also generates dimethyl sulfide, mm-hmm. which gets into the atmosphere as aerosols, mm-hmm. and then becomes a part of the cloud radiation, if you like, modulation.
Decreases clouds?
No.
No.
It increases.
Increases.
Yeah. And that is a negative feedback.
You mean it acts as a catalyst?
No, it acts as a cloud nuclei.
That's what I meant, a nuclei.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Yeah.
Condensation
nuclei.
Yes.
Okay, I understand. How about the effect of ozone depletion? Ray Smith tells me that from his experiments in Santa Barbara, that it's...
Let me put it this way, I feel confident of what I've been telling you. I've much less confident of on the subject of ozone, because but there are certain things about the ozone theories that I would question. I don't question the chemistry. I think the definitive experiment was the NASA U2, you know, the Antarctic experiment.
Yeah, Susan Solomon from here.
Yeah, well, the Aeronomy Lab, was running the science. I've talked with the science director on that experiment in some detail. And one of the fascinating things is they flew out of Punta Arenas and made a lot of in-situ measurements where the reaction is taking place. And this is in the Antarctic Peninsula region. Mm-hmm. In this region, they found, indeed, they had the stratospheric clouds, mm-hmm. and they took in-situ measurements, and they found a very highly layered structure. They found that these clouds, you know, are like maybe 500 feet thick, extend over vast areas, and in between you had clear air layers of 1,000 or 500 feet thick. Very laminated in that sense. In their measurements, they found that in the clear area parts, there is no ozone depletion. In the clouds, it's almost 100%, like 90, somewhere between 95 and 100%.
All the ozone in those cloud layers?
In those layers, you know, see, the chemistry, the theory of the chemistry has been that the effective reaction has to occur on the surface of a droplet.
Yeah, droplet.
And this appears to be true, because in the regions where the clouds are present, the depletion is almost complete. As I say, it's between 95% and 100%. But in the clear areas in between, it's very small. Now that raises some interesting questions. One thing that it raises is that what if the chlorine content were twice as great as it is now? You're not going to get twice as much depletion if you're already getting nearly 100%. You follow me?
Mm-hmm, I do.
Or vice versa. Mm-hmm. Suppose it were half as great.
Won't change.
The same kind of question.
Yeah.
The chemists have no answer to this. Now, where I have some questions about the accepted theory is that the accepted theory is that temperature has to be very low, mm-hmm. below minus 80, mm-hmm. roughly. You have to have the stratospheric clouds present, because mm-hmm. the chemical reaction occurs only on the surface of the droplets. And thirdly, you have to have the catalyst, which is normally assumed to be chlorine. It can be another halogen like bromine and so on, but chlorine is the dominant one. Those are the three conditions. Mm-hmm. Now, what all the chemists have assumed is that the meteorological conditions are a constant, and that the variables are the amount of chlorine and the temperature, which can reflect meteorological factors. But in my estimation, I would question that assumption, because, as I mentioned before, if you look at the behavior of the system as reflected in the COADS data set, for example, the most variable feature is the strength of atmospheric circulation. Now, the stratospheric clouds are like the Sierra wave, mm-hmm. and like the waves that occur over mm-hmm. Boulder. Yeah. They're orographically induced. And that is why they occur mainly in the wet LC region, where you have westerly circulation, mm-hmm. and you have the extension of the Andes mm-hmm. in the Antarctic Peninsula, and you have orographic stimulation of these stratospheric clouds. as the strength of the circulation changes, it's manifested throughout the system. You see it in the surface wind that I've been quoting about, but it will also, has got to be reflected in the strength of the upper level winds and the clouds. In the northern hemisphere, that is why Scandinavia has always been the home of lenticular clouds, for example.
I was going to ask you about lenticular clouds.
Well, you've got Greenland is the big orographic feature that's upwind of them. And the clouds are well developed. The North Atlantic is pretty narrow at that point. But Norway and Sweden has been, you know, where stratospheric clouds have been studied and discovered and so on, because that's where they occur. And the reason they are so prominent there is because of the orography and the presence of Greenland. In Antarctica, it's the Antarctic Peninsula, which is the main feature. But my point is, because they have no observing system that observes the time variability of this, they assume that that's a constant. Whereas, just looking at the dynamics, I would expect that that's the most dynamic factor, that that's a hell of a lot more variable than the amount of chlorine. As a matter of fact, the amount of chlorine in the atmosphere, mainly from chlorofluorocarbons in recent decades, in the decade from the mid-70s to the mid-80s, that was almost constant. But the Antarctic ozone hole, you know, it started about 1980, or 79, I guess, was the first noticeable year. And the amount of chlorine didn't change during that period. And I would guess that the thing that changed really was the presence of the amount of the stratospheric clouds. So that's one aspect that I'm very suspicious of.
But didn't the volcanic reactions of Pinatubo and others also contribute to the
chlorine? Oh, I think, yes.
And how much the chlorine is natural and how much is man-induced, percentage-wise?
I have read about this and I have asked this question, and I think the argument that the chemists make is that that man is responsible for almost all of the stratospheric chlorine, put it that way. Besides chlorine, there are certain oxides, NOx, can play the same role in ozone destruction. And I question this part a little bit too, because NOx is generated, after all, 21 or 78% of the atmosphere is nitrogen. And the NOx products are developed by lightning, mainly. And so you would expect the amount of NOx generation to be proportional, again, to convective and activity, because that's what generates lightning. This is totally ignored by the ozone community, put it that way. So it is just another question that I think needs to be sorted out.
Yeah. Well, very interesting. Would you like to go to dinner? May I take you to dinner?
Oh, well,
I have actually no idea where to go.
Make it easy on yourself. You have a family and you're visiting and...
Oh, wait, I'm going to be here for another week, and I've been here a week already. My family doesn't expect me back till later.
Yeah, all right. Well, no, I can go out to dinner. As a matter of fact, one of those phone calls that we had was to invite me to dinner, and then I said, well, no, I'm planning to go with a friend. They said, bring your friend, but I didn't accept that. I thought it better to...
Oh, we can do that if you like, too.
To stay separate.
Uh-huh.
You know, I didn't accept, I wouldn't want to call back down.
Yeah, I understand. Well, this has been fascinating. It's certainly a lot broader than polar stuff.
Before we go, though, let me finish by showing you a couple of these things.
I'm going to shut this off, okay?
Yeah.